Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Don't forget, at the bottom of the hour, around 11:30, we'll have a call-in for anyone who follows a webcam for fun in law enforcement, inspired by the Guardian article today on these Aussies in pubs around Australia who watch a series of U.S.-Mexico border webcams that are supposed to catch people sneaking in or people smuggling drugs. Well, they do it for entertainment. Then we heard from a listener who watches red-tailed hawks in Philadelphia on another webcam. We want you to log in to your favorite webcam at 11:30 and call us and tell us at that time what you're seeing in real time, okay? So coming up at 11:30. Right now, cities, states, and national leaders are all trying their hardest to figure out how to bring this country out of the economic doldrums. They're looking to economists, historians, past elected officials. But I wonder if they're asking themselves, what would Karl Marx do? Now, before you just dismiss this, we're going to talk to a leading social theorist who's been teaching Marx's Das Kapital for 40 years. He's also got his own theories about this economic crisis and how to rescue capitalism from the capitalists. He is David Harvey, Distinguished Professor of Anthropology at the Graduate Center at the City University, and he's the author of several books, including The Limits to Capital and A Brief History of Neoliberalism, which came out in 2005. And he joins us now in our studios. Professor Harvey, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
So is this the crisis of capitalism that Marxists have long been waiting for?
Well, Marx held that capitalism was crisis-prone all the time. And I think one of the things we have to do right now is to set this particular crisis in context, that actually over the last 30, 40 years there have been about hundreds of financial crises, some of them major. And after all, we went through our own long-term capital management crash in 1998, and we went through the savings and loan crash. So it's not as if this is new. The only thing this time is it's bigger, it's broader, and it's global. So I think we have to look at it as a crisis-prone system, but the crises have become more frequent and deeper over the last 30 years.
And what do you see as the genesis of the current crisis?
The main genesis actually arose out of the crisis of the 1970s, which was the last big one we really went through, when certain solutions were arrived at, which included pushing very hard to globalize everything and pushing very hard to use finance to do it. So in a sense, we got the financialization of everything that occurred in the 1970s, and then that has taken off in its own way and produced the present mess.
And so do you think the subprime mortgage crisis and the real estate boom fit into that picture?
Absolutely. And the interesting thing is, when you look back, I mentioned the savings and loan. That was a property-led boom. The Japanese crisis of the late 1980s was land. The Swedish banks had to be nationalized because of overinvestment in property markets. So actually, many of the crises we've had over the last 30 years have been led, have been property market-led. They've been urban-based.
And you have compared real estate bubbles to a sort of Ponzi scheme, which is something that's in the news now, a term because of the illegal work of Bernard Madoff. But explain the comparison and how you think it's played out here in New York.
I think two things about this. One is rich people got inestimably richer after the 1970s, mainly because of what we call wage repression. Real wages didn't rise. The rich got much richer. And then the question was, what were they going to invest in? Now, we're told it's good the rich get rich because they invest and they create jobs. But actually, a lot of the time they invest in assets, control of assets. They invest in the stock market. The stock market goes up, so they say, this is a good investment. Let's invest more in the stock market. So by definition, the stock market has a Ponzi character. Same thing happens with property. You start investing in property, property prices go up. You invest more in property, property prices keep on going up. So actually, since the 1970s, a lot of investment has gone into control of assets rather than actually creating anything new in production.
I'm sure that's true. And we have a clip of President Obama saying something to that effect. So this isn't just from a Marxist social theorist on the outside, but I think we heard a very similar sentiment from the President of the United States in his news conference just the other night.
I mean, when you have an economy in which the majority of growth is coming from the financial sector, when AIG selling a derivative is counted as an increase in the gross domestic product, then that's not a model for sustainable economic growth. And what we have to do is invest in those things that will allow the American people's capacity for ingenuity and innovation, their ability to take risks, but make sure that those risks are grounded in good products and good services that they believe they can market to the rest of the country.
So he said there when derivatives sold by AIG are counted toward the gross domestic product, that's an illusion. Is that the same thing that you just expressed?
Yes, so very much. Of course, lots of things count to the gross domestic product. For example, if we have a huge increase in car accidents, the repair of the car goes to gross domestic product. So it's not necessarily a measure of well-being at all. It's just a matter of, you know, how much money is changing hands for what purpose.
Of course, maybe even by just juxtaposing you and him at all, I need to say, but he's no Marxist, right?
Right.
Contrary to what we sometimes hear on the conservative press.
Yeah, no, he's no Marxist at all. That's true.
But, you know, you talk about this being fake, and, to some degree, I think current events are showing that it was a house of cards. On the other hand, does the implosion that we're experiencing right now to some degree prove the trickle-down theory, whether you want to attribute it to Ronald Reagan or anybody else? Because a lot of money did trickle down into real estate and jobs and everything else, as measured by the fact that so many jobs are disappearing now that all that wealth, call it imaginary if you will, has gone away.
It trickle down is a sort of funny word. It assumes that wealth trickles down. Actually, what tends to happen is that the mass of the people who get employed, and you're right, we've had a reasonably full employment economy in the United States in the 1990s onwards, but the wage rates were very low, extremely low, and of course, as we know, the social protections were negligible. So it's not as if well-being trickled down. A certain kind of job structure was created, which was very low wage, very badly protected, which actually then produced goods, which allowed the rich, if you like, to get even richer.
And we can take phone calls for CUNY anthropology professor David Harvey with his Marxist theory view of the current financial crisis, 212-433-WNYC. 433-9692, or post a comment or a question to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Building on what you were just saying, did the construction boom in New York simultaneously lead to foreclosure and to gentrification?
It led to gentrification first, and of course displacement by eminent domain and all those other kind of problems and the creation of homelessness. So it led to all of that. And now it's led, of course, to foreclosure. So we have the ridiculous situation, which was, I think, really highlighted in this morning's newspaper, of homeless people camping out in tents in Sacramento in the midst of a landscape where there are empty houses which have been foreclosed on. That is irrational, in my view, incredibly irrational.
Do we have a fixation on home ownership in this country? Should we be talking about other ways to house people?
I think there's been a myth of home ownership for a very long time, which really goes back to the 1930s. And there was a great statement back then that kind of said a debt-encumbered homeowner doesn't go on strike. So, in a sense, home ownership has always been sold to the American people as a way of participating in the American dream, but it's also been a means of achieving stability, social stability. Since the 1930s, of course, home ownership has been pushed and pushed and pushed. And what we saw in the foreclosure stuff is that actually it got pushed down to levels where it was completely unreasonable to try to create it.
What's an alternative?
I think, well, the obvious alternative is renting, and I think that most people would be better off renting than they would owning. But I think actually there are other alternatives, real co-op living, not the kind we have here in New York, but also social housing, which has a long history of actually being quite successful in many parts of the world.
Of course, renting perpetuates the relationship between a landowner, the landlord, and the renter.
Yes. So I'm not in favor of renting, but the advantage of renting is that if jobs move, you can move pretty easily. Whereas, as you know, buying and selling a house is a very costly business. I mean, the amount of money you have to spend on it in New York City is huge. So there's a stickiness that comes with home ownership.
Do you think that this crisis changes who wins and who loses in the economy going forward? Is there, to some degree, a great leveling going on now if it's the people at the top who are seeing so much of their wealth disappear?
I think it may be the people at the top are being thinned out, as it were, but I think they are ending up with a lot more power than we went into it. I mean, that is the nature of this crisis. There's a great saying from Andrew Mellon way back in 1913 who said, in a crisis, assets return to their rightful owners, i.e. him. And I think that what we have right now is a consolidation of class power on Wall Street and elsewhere. I mean, after all, we've now got four main banks left. It's a tremendous consolidation of power. And they're basically dictating, I think, the terms of the bailout and how the stimulus package is going to be constructed and all the rest of it.
Well, you've said that you don't think the stimulus package passed by Congress and signed by President Obama is going to work, because basically it's not nearly enough money and won't be prolonged enough to bring us out of this crisis. Is it just a matter of how big the boat is?
No. The bigness is important, but the other side of it is it's very badly targeted. If you want to give a stimulus, you don't cut taxes, for example, because if you cut taxes to people in nervous times, they're going to save it or they're going to retire their debt. That's no stimulus to the economy. You want them to spend it. And the same happens with the infrastructure projects. You send off money to the municipalities and say to the municipalities, do what you like with it. So one mayor decides to build their favorite highway system. Somebody else decides to do something else. This is a very incoherent kind of way to try to construct a stimulus package.
And you've criticized Mayor Bloomberg for spending stimulus money for programs like his Wall Street banker retraining program, which he announced a few weeks ago.
Absolutely. I think that's pretty outrageous.
On the other hand, he says he doesn't have to lay off 14,000 teachers who he would have had to otherwise.
With the stimulus package, yes, correct. He can certainly do that, which I think is very important. But that is one of the coherent parts of the stimulus package, which is targeted on education, which of course Obama is very concerned about.
Let's play another clip of the president. This is about China buying our debt, which a lot of people fear is unsustainable. And at Tuesday's news conference, a reporter asked President Obama if he worried about maybe indications that China's confidence in the U.S. dollar is waning. Here's his response.
I would just point out that the dollar is extraordinarily strong right now. And the reason the dollar is strong right now is because investors consider the United States the strongest economy in the world, with the most stable political system in the world. So you don't have to take my word for it. I think that there is a great deal of confidence that ultimately, although we are going through a rough patch, that the prospects for the world economy are very, very strong.
Showing again that Barack Obama is no Marxist. But yes. What do you make of that and his confidence in the dollar long term and our system?
I think he's right in the sense that if you said to yourself, where else could you put your money right now? And you thought of putting it in euros, for example, and you looked at the structure of the European Union and said, would you have confidence in the fractious group of people to run it coherently? I think, yes, he's right that the dollar is about the only place you can put your money. But there's a lot of nervousness, I think, in international markets as to whether the dollar is going to be sustained at its current levels, given the tremendous amounts of money that are having to be borrowed to finance the trillion-dollar bailouts.
David Harvey, CUNY anthropology professor, my guest on WNYC. His books include The Limits to Capitalism. And let's take a phone call. Mark in Irvington, you're on WNYC. Hello, Mark.
Oh, thank you so much. Fascinating. And I'm so interested to hear the professor. But my parents grew up in the former, Soviet bloc. They escaped from the former Czechoslovakia. And so I grew up, with that legacy. And I'm just interested, I mean, is that what the professor sees as the model, that Stalinism and communism, and it's, of course, capitalism has all these problems, but it's also created the American dream. It's created the untold wealth in the world. I mean, does he really want us to go back to that model?
The answer is no. I don't think we go back to any model. And one of the great things that Marx pointed out is that at any point in history and wherever you are geographically, you have to do the analysis all over again to find out exactly what is possible in the here and now and what an alternative kind of social structure could be like. And I think we have to do that right now. So we don't take a formula from Marx or from Lenin or from Stalin or anybody else and say that is the formula we want. We actually have to invent entirely a new definition of what socialism might be, what communism might be. And it is very interesting. You know, we've been through 30 years of being told individualism is this and individualism of that, but actually right now you can hear from almost everybody, they're dying for new forms of social solidarity, new structures of belonging, and actually that is a kind of a, if you like, a socialist ethic which is beginning to come through in the way in which people are responding to this crisis.
Mark, do you want to respond at all?
It's just that every time communism is tried throughout the world, it ends up with the Khmer Rouge, it ends up with blood, it ends up with state domination and horror. That is the legacy of communism, which is a direct outgrowth of Marxist theory. I mean, I just don't see how one can separate the two. You have this incredible legacy of the 20th century Marxism as it was practiced, and we can dream about other alternatives, but it seems to be nothing more than a dream.
Thank you, Mark. Can there be Marxism, if you want to use that word, without totalitarianism or authoritarianism? We saw how unspeakable that has become, unless you just want to talk about Western European social democracy.
I think there are, well, first off, I want to defend to some degree, the aspect of what international communism has been about. And there are, you know, you can mention Khmer Rouge and all that, and I'll mention Pinochet, and we can just trade those things mm-hmm. against each other. But the fact is that, in a place like Cuba, which I don't necessarily approve of, but on the other hand, the infant mortality rate in Cuba is lower than it is in the United States. Their educational capacities are really quite startling. So, you know, a place like Cuba has done some extremely positive things as well as some negative things. And I think we have to look at all of that and sort of say, look, what are the good things we can take out of this, yeah, and what are the bad things that we have to reject?
But I can hear a lot of people out there going, oh, he's going to Cuba.
No, I'm just trying to defend the fact that this idea that all communism was awful, you know, and actually a lot of people in Russia now are kind of saying, hey, give us communism back,
yeah,
from what's happened.
But, I mean, I think it goes to a critique that many people have made of Marx and Marxist theory, which is, yeah, Marx actually nailed a lot about capitalism. He
yes.
got really
yes.
a lot right.
Yes.
What he didn't get was the alternative, which nobody has really come up with.
He never really wrote out what the alternative should be. That's the interesting thing. He basically said it's for us to decide in our particular historical and geographical circumstances what the alternative should be. And that's my position. I say, well, right now we've got to start with that because we've got this incredible mess on our hands, the world collapsing in poverty, stock markets all over the place. So we've got to do something different, and the something different has to be a major shift.
Here's one model that I know that you have been interested in, and that is something that they're doing in Brazil called the right to the city. Familiar with that?
Yes, oh, indeed.
Tell me about it.
The right to the city is about trying to say to people in a city, everyone in a city, that you have a right not simply to be here, but you have a right to say something about what shall happen in this city. American cities tend to be dominated by a small elite and the developers and the, you know, construction interests and all the rest of it. And the mass of the population has very little say. So a right to the city movement is about trying to get us back to the idea of democratizing decision-making about what the city should be like and where it should go. I mean, Bloomberg has the right to New York City in the sense that he exercises a tremendous power in this city. But what about the homeless? And when the homeless kind of tried to get in and talk to Bloomberg and say, well, we have a right to say something about what's going to happen in the city, they got arrested. Now, this is not, it seems to me, how a democracy should really work. So the right to the city is about trying to reclaim, if you like, popular power in a city and to democratize decisions about what happens in a city.
David Harvey, author of The Limits to Capital and A Brief History of Neoliberalism, my guest on WNYC. Victoria in White Plains, you're on WNYC. Hi, Victoria.
Hi. I originally called regarding the reason why wages are so low. Basically because there's a glut of workers out there, mostly the illegal aliens that have been coming in and taking jobs for anything they can get. So therefore, wages are kept down pretty low. But this the caller that you had that spoke regarding communism being tried anywhere, it hasn't worked, and you cite Cuba. I think that's absurd because Cuba, first of all, when Castro got sick, he flew his doctor in from somewhere else. He didn't use Cuban medicine. He Cuban doctors.
So let me get a response, Victoria. We're running out of time. Go to the immigration point. Capital flows across borders. Should labor be able to flow across borders to match it if we're in that kind of system? And what do you think about immigration in the context of your idea?
This is very interesting. Back in the 1960s, when there were shortages of labor in this country, the U.S. reformed the immigration law to give, if you like, U.S. capital access to the global labor force. Since then, of course, all kinds of other things have happened. So the low wages may have something to do with that, but they also have something to do with a man called Reagan, who fought off and destroyed a lot of union power. It also has a lot to do with the offshoring that's gone on of capital going over to China and Mexico and all those other places. There are all sorts of reasons why the wage rate has been kept low since the 1970s. And in a sense, it's a political strategy and been a political strategy all along of corporate capital to try to keep wages low as possible in order that profits can be as high as possible.
Last thing, and on this point, labor, you have said that in the global capitalist economy there is brewing major labor unrest. Certainly in the financial crisis, we're seeing demonstrations in China, we're seeing demonstrations in France. There was a pessimist quoted on the New York Times op-ed page today saying that we're going to be seeing, you know, shanty towns in Central Park and labor unrest in Detroit. What do you see coming?
I'm not a great predictor of the future. You know, whenever we try to predict, it always turns out we're wrong. I think that there are signs of mounting labor unrest in many parts of the world, and it's going to be different in different places. My guess is it's likely to be biggest in China, and I suspect that the Chinese government is very, very concerned, which is why it is launching a massive kind of a Keynesian program to try to rescue and try to bolster the conditions of labor in that country.
Communist Keynesianism.
Absolutely.
From Beijing. All right. David Harvey is going to be part of a panel discussion with other theorists on Monday night talking about some of this stuff. It's part of the Lower Manhattan Cultural Council's lecture series called Access Restricted. But I think access is not actually restricted, and we have a link to it on our site. David Harvey, Distinguished Professor of Anthropology at the Graduate Center of CUNY. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Now it is time for that call in for anyone who follows a webcam for fun or law enforcement or any other reason. Log on to your favorite webcam. Call in right now and tell us what you're seeing. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 with your favorite webcam, especially if you're looking at it.